Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Tom Edwards. On this week's show...
The scale of it is daunting, that's for sure, and it's probably what's kept it from changing. And it's probably what's keeping it from changing, because people look at it and say, how could we possibly change this thing? But it's an amazing opportunity, it's so big that you could do lots of things in it.
Andrew Tuck went to Poland this week as global architects, developers and City Hall asked, would a new grand project be good for Warsaw? And in Malaysia, we report from UN Habitat's World Urban Forum and ask delegates, what happens here and should we care? That's all coming up in the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Tom Edwards. Warsaw is a city that has had a tumultuous history. During the Second World War, much of it was reduced to rubble, and when the communists rebuilt, they didn't always put quality of life at the top of their agenda. And then years of economic success delivered fresh challenges and some projects that seemed more about making money than delivering a joined-up urban vision. But our editor, Andrew Tuck, has just returned from the city where a new generation of developers and civic leaders are actually thinking big and beautiful, including what could be done with the vast square in front of the Stalinist-era Palace of Culture that's currently largely used as a car and coach park and the odd fast food stand. With this challenge in mind, the Urban Land Institute in Poland organised a debate that brought together a group of international urbanists in Warsaw on a sunny but chilly February day. The big question was, can high-profile projects change the image of the city and hopefully create some vitality too? First, let's hear from John Banker, the chairman of the Urban Land Institute, who tells us why he organised the event.
First of all, I wanted to give back something to the community, to the city of Warsaw, and that's actually why I became involved with ULI in the first place. And second, just speaking of ULI, I wanted to introduce a different format to the usual two-day conference, which drags on for all day and kind of lose focus sometimes. I wanted to do something different, contacting our constituents more often and bring topics on a more focused level to those people more frequently.
Now, the question here was, does this city need a grand projet, a big idea? I've got a feeling you think it does.
I absolutely think it does. As you see that Warsaw is kind of growing in many different areas, but it really lacks a visual focus. I think it lacks an identity for those people who don't know it very well. So something in the very center of the city where there is an opportunity currently, I think the city would be very well served with that type of a project.
Now, we went to see this plot. It's outside the Palace Culture, which is this Rococo kind of fancy cake of a building.
It's a lot of things.
Built during the communist era, supposedly a hint from Stalin that it was a good thing to build. Mm-hmm. The city has a bit of a troubled relationship with it, but yes. The space around it has become overrun, as we heard. What would be your vision for that?
I think that the things we talked about today, i.e. having a strong vision from the very top, but also community involvement, are two elements which have to come together here, and the ideals will flow. Sometimes, and I know people are frustrated that nothing has happened in that space for so many years, but sometimes it's good that the first vision or the first proposal that is submitted isn't acted upon. It's really good to take time and make sure you get the process right, and it does take a long time. So it's a fantastic opportunity for Warsaw. I think that the time is ripe to be talking for a solution that involves both ideas from the community, but also a vision for the entire city.
Now, I asked you earlier today whether you were confident about what's happening in the city. This is a city where growth is immense, where people are building high rises, where there's a lot of speculative money around, which can be a challenge. But you feel positive about the future of Warsaw.
I am positive about Warsaw because the dialogue, which is so necessary to create and act upon any kind of vision, is just coming into play here. For years, my memory in Warsaw, which is 20-some years, the mayor has always kind of been, the mayoralty of Warsaw has been a position from which to leap into the national stage. And I think finally, activism at grassroots level have demanded a new type of mayor in Warsaw, someone who really is devoted only to the city, doesn't have aspirations necessarily to become prime minister. And that dialogue between City Hall and NGOs at the grassroots level, I think, is finally starting to happen.
And the property developers you know and the people who are investing in the city that you know, are they beginning to understand that there's a need for public realm, that there's a need for quality of life, that the things that we talked about today with Millennium Park and with Bilbao, that people want to come together and, you know, be out on the streets and enjoy their cities in a way that maybe we didn't imagine 20 years ago?
I think developers here are as developers are anywhere. They look for low-hanging fruit, they look for quick profits, and they look to make the best returns for their investors' capital. But they also realize that Warsaw is a city in need of those types of spaces, in need of certain types of facilities, and you can make money doing that as well. And I think finally, the examples that we see in other parts of Europe and in the world indeed, developers are seeing that those can be applied to Warsaw. The food hall that we went to today, finally we have one in Warsaw, but that took years to happen. And it's doing very well, thank you. I think that carries over into other sectors as well, residential, office, and cultural facilities.
And finally, just tell me what an opportunity you think for the city is and maybe a challenge that they have to contemplate and face up to.
I think we only walked upon a bit of that street which fronts onto the Place des Filades. That entire street, which is called Marszałkowska, Marshall Street, is really the prime opportunity in Warsaw. It's the spine of the city. If you can get that right from, let's say, its length through the entire center city, then you'll have the beginnings of an amazing center city. That's the challenge.
Andrew also had a chance to speak with Marlena Hapacz, who's the chief city architect of Warsaw. They walked to that square, Place des Filades, or Parade Square, in front of the Palace of Culture and Science. And Marlena explained the scale of the problem.
We are in the center of Warsaw, and this is a huge empty square around the very important building for us, the Palace of Science and Culture. And this is the space with a long and difficult story, because before war, it was the typical city with quarters, with buildings, with many inhabitants. And then it was changed for the big square for parades and defilades. And now it's a huge parking space. And we really want to change it for living heart of the city. So we are waiting for first building and we are still thinking what we can do with this space.
Now you've brought us to a podium where the communist leaders used to stand when they were watching those parades. And in front of us we have this vast palace of culture that was built in the Stalinist era in Warsaw. But as you say, around us is this huge car park and it should be a square these days. So what is the first building that you're hoping might come here?
The first building, it will be the Museum of Modern Art. Thomas Pfeiffer is the author of this building. And actually, this is only the part of project, because the architect was planning two buildings which are corresponding together. So first, we want to start construction of the museum, and then we want to have the second one, the theater. And the theater, it will be something very unusual, because two walls of the buildings you can open, and you can have some kind of spectacle, of performance between the building and the square, or between the building and the park, because we have the park from the other side of this building.
And what do you think this will do for Warsaw if you have a new project like this, if you activate this huge square and make it into better public space?
I think this is the very important space for Warsaw, because, you know, it has some kind of local character, but at the same time, this is the heart of the metropolis. And what I think is important, there is no life here. So we really need many things here, not one thing, not one building, but many new functions here to do something completely different than we have now.
And tell me, all the time you're juggling history here. We have buildings from the communist era, memories from what the city was before the war, before the Germans and the Russians came here. Are you mindful of all those things when you're planning, thinking how you bring back some of the old life of the city too?
Yes, exactly. And so this is that space with history, but also this is the space of our, you know, democracy. If we want to show that something changed in our society, I think this is the space for this. Also, it wasn't only the decision of the city, but also the decision of activists from the city. We have a very important process of consultation, of public consultation here. And I think this space here, it's maybe something similar to Potsdamer Platz in Berlin. You know, almost everybody in Warsaw has some ideas for this space. So I think that this discussion about this place and the character of the future space. So we are looking not for one solution, but for something which we can change every day, every month, every season, you know, to use it as well for big concert, but also just for take coffee and talk with friends.
A man that knows how to make use of empty space is Daniel Ringelstein. He's one of the main people behind the Millennium Park in Chicago, where he helped turn a Seen Better Days park and the air above the rail tracks into the city's beating and green heart. Andrew asked him about the epic task facing Warsaw.
It's a tremendous opportunity, and it's very similar to the challenge of Millennium Park. The scale of it is daunting, that's for sure, and it's probably what's kept it from changing. And it's probably what's keeping it from changing, because people look at it and say, how could we possibly change this thing? But it's an amazing opportunity. It's so big that you could do lots of things in it. You know, you could just greening it up as a first step, bringing events, which it sounds like that's what they're doing, bringing civic buildings to continue the history of the site as a cultural place and a civic place seems right. But also you have to bring probably some development to make it sort of pan out. How can you make the numbers work to actually deliver something, a benefit? So it's of a certain scale and magnitude that's very exciting because it's obviously a landmark space in the city. A lot of interesting cultural history to it, which will bring along with it quite an interesting debate, I suppose. But it's a incredible opportunity.
Now, when we think of grand projet, and that's what we're here a little bit to talk about today, they can go wrong, but in Chicago went very right. What were the two or three ingredients at the top of the pile that you think made it a success, that made it more than just, you know, a mayor showing off or a nice piece of green space?
A combination of things that really made it happen. One was definitely strong city leadership, obviously in the form of Mayor Daley, that led the project, that set the vision, that set the course, and make sure everyone organized themselves to get this project done for a certain deadline. Next, it was a huge investment of the private sector and people of the community who donated millions of dollars to help the project grow from even the city's original vision to what we see today. And the third, it's really the role of the artists and the landscape that was brought to the project. So what really brought the project to life is the artwork, engaging artwork and the programs and the continual shepherding of events and curating events throughout the year to make it a wonderful place, not just a garden, but a place where people can come to see a concert, to go ice skating, or just sit out in a cafe.
Now, we have the city architect on the panel later on, and we were just chatting to her outside. When they begin to think of those things, so Warsaw isn't Chicago, it's got a more complicated history, and we're just hearing just the very nature of the history that's happened on the very steps of this building and in the square, there's lots more things to think about. So do you think they should look at what Chicago has done, or do you think they need to come up with a more individualized plan for what they need to do?
Obviously, every problem like this, particularly the scale, needs its own bespoke solution locally. But they can take lots of lessons learned from places like Chicago and Bilbao and other places around the world that have done these really big, important civic projects. You do need strong leadership, and that leadership's got to rally the troops and get people on board, people who don't see advantage in it for them. So getting some sort of senior leadership is critical, whether it's at the government scale or business leadership that comes together. And also involving the community. If the community doesn't feel like the vision that's coming out is good for them, then they will revolt against it and you won't have any success. So it's a combination of top-down, bottom-up.
Now, I always imagine these projects work very easily in cities that are nice and sunny and warm. Now, Chicago isn't famed for its kind of tropical climate either, nor is Warsaw, I can tell you, after being out there today.
Yes.
In a way, how did you ensure that the Chicago project was buzzing come winter, come snow as well?
You're right. We find our advantage, take our small opportunities in a place like Warsaw, Chicago with continental weather. So it's really about hunkering down and finding smaller spaces that can be more utilized and more comfortable in the wintertime. So in Chicago, it's really just the ice rink. So it's not trying to use the whole park, but use pieces of the park that are closer to the city, faster walk to a more air-conditioned place, but also providing facilities in the park that people can use in the wintertime, whether it be ice skating rink or cafes that are warming places, or an events venue there, for example, which turns 180 degrees to have performance looking the opposite way than the summertime.
So finally, the question is that we're answering today, is there a space for the big project? You know, even here on Monocle and on the Urbanist, we often focus on the smaller details of cities that make things right. But are you still a believer in the big plan, the grand vision?
I grew up in Chicago, make no small plans. No, absolutely. I think you see wonderful examples all over the world. But the big plan is not the only answer. There's no silver bullet. It's hard work. So you need both.
Here's what else we're following this week. There are a few people that look forward to the morning commute in a big city. It doesn't matter how you do it. Packed streets, buses and carriages make most people feel slightly uneasy. But in London, for the first time in 20 years, fewer people are riding on the Underground than in the previous year. Transport for London estimates 20 million fewer people are riding the Tube. It may just be 2% of all trips, but why is it happening? First up is the price. Despite London Mayor Sadiq Khan's fare freeze, it's still an expensive means of transport, especially for regular travellers. Then there's the way people travel. Cycling's now the most popular form of rush hour transport on London's streets, according to a new study by the City of London Corporation. So perhaps it's not all about Uber after all. From one drop in numbers to another, in the United States, there's been a sharp decline in urban crime. It's currently at the lowest level since the first half of the 20th century. Take New York City, for example, where the number of people murdered each year has dropped from around 2,000 to fewer than 330. This is a trend that's being observed all over the country, and as such, it has broader implications, mainly on quality of life, because less violence means more people enjoying city life, feeling comfortable to roam the streets, to travel on public transit, and socialise after the sun sets, as The New Yorker's Adam Gopnik points out in a piece this week. And if you like the sound of that sort of thing, you can hear more from Adam in an upcoming edition of Monocle magazine. And if you thought that was just an American trend, look to Japan, where crime rates have dropped their lowest levels in 70 years. It all comes down to the economics, declining unemployment rates, and better coordination between local citizens, the police, and security forces. When it comes to regulating the city, sometimes inaction is better than making a bad decision. That certainly might be the case for the city of Los Angeles. Last week, new restrictions came into place, dictating where and when people that live in their vehicles can park to sleep overnight. If you live in a car or RV, you can't park within 450 metres of schools, daycare centres, parks, or in any residential street between 9pm and 6am. While city officials say it's about making clear when and where you can park your car, the more than 7,000 people that live this way are sure not to see it quite like that. With so-called offenders set to be fined between $25 and $75, this is surely just going to increase the problem of homelessness in the city rather than helping to fix it. We head to Malaysia now, where mayors, city officials and urban planners assembled earlier this month for the United Nations-endorsed World Urban Forum. Delegates at the six-day conference in Kuala Lumpur were given the near-impossible task of deciding how to implement the New Urban Agenda, a set of principles that's intended to guide global urbanisation over the next two decades. The gathering this year was a homecoming of sorts for the former mayor of the Malaysian island of Penang. Maimunah Maud Sharif was appointed head of UN Habitat at the end of last year and now oversees the UN's Urban Development Agency from New Digs in Nairobi. Monocle's associate bureau chief in Singapore, Zayana Zulkifli, went to Kuala Lumpur for us. Here's what she found.
Hi, my name is Nicholas Yu. I'm an independent advisor on urban sustainability and governance. And for the last few days, I have been supporting dialogues between business and civil society, also working together with the General Assembly of Partners, which is an assembly of partners that for the first time we've been able to get all the stakeholders to speak with one voice. That happened at Habitat 3. And now, of course, we're moving towards implementation. I think what is emerging from this World Urban Forum is actually something that's quite positive, is that people are really digging in their heels to get prepared for implementation. So implementation is in the vocabulary everywhere. I think there are certain groups that are still searching what are the best means by which they can implement, but there is definitely a groundswell of optimism that, yes, if we pull together, if we work together in partnerships, we can actually do something real on the ground. A major challenge will be how do we empower local authorities sufficiently so that they can implement these global agendas on the ground. Local action will be a key component for the realization of these Sustainable Development Goals. So that's one barrier. There are also other barriers. Of course, it's hard to know if you're making progress if you can't measure it. And we have a whole series of indicators that are out there. How do we collect the data? Who's going to collect the data? Who's going to analyze it? This is still very much up in the air. Everybody has a role to play. Definitely, central government has a very critical role to play. They are the ones that have to set the overall policy framework and basically incentivize all the other stakeholders to chip in. Local authorities also have a critical role to play. Civil society and private sector, they constitute society in general. But without the leadership, without strong leadership from local authorities, you know, their actions can only go so far. This forum is the only forum I know of where government, local government, and all the stakeholders are brought together under one roof in a very non-formal way. The dialogues are freewheeling, they're moderated, but without any formality, because it is a UN meeting, but it's unique in that it's non-legislative. So people are not sitting behind their flags, so to speak, right? Everybody's equal, everybody enters into a dialogue, and that's the strength of a forum like this.
I'm Katelijne Verstraeten. I'm the Director of Arts and Creative Industries for the British Council in East Asia. So that's Northeast Asia, Southeast Asia, New Zealand, Australia, where we have offices in those 14 countries. The World Urban Forum was something, you know, it's a key platform internationally, obviously, and particularly now with the moment that it's going to the new urban agenda and its implementation, particularly the title of this forum being Cities for All and looking towards 2030, which isn't that far away. We, as the British Council, you know, we're very interested in exploring what the conversations really are, you know, how this urban agenda could be taken to the next stage and potentially what the British Council's role could be in adding value to this conversation. So it's a massive forum, obviously, so it's very interesting to observe, you know, the different stakeholders who are involved. I particularly found it very interesting how I was focusing particularly on looking at how, what is the role of arts and culture in discussing the new urban agenda. And the reason why is that with the Sustainable Development Goals, actually the role of arts and culture is not explicitly there, but it's about, I think, mainstreaming it. So it's about having a cultural starting point at every conversation, be it on women and girls, or be it on equality, or be it on cities specifically. You know, what actually is that? Because in the past, I think a lot maybe went wrong when, because there was not a real deeper understanding of the role of culture and culture change. So that's something where I feel that that's important. The World Urban Forum is about cities, right? And it's about urban development. And urban development, particularly Cities for All, is where the people are at the core. Now, what we do as a British Council is a cultural relations organisation between the UK and the rest of the world and creating better understanding and learning from each other. And we believe that our organisation can play a role in that. We work a lot with cities in the UK and cities, let's say, for example, we have a very good connection between Bandung and Liverpool. So we set up those connections, or we enable those connections and create opportunities and partnerships between partners in the UK and abroad. And that's exactly our mandate, you know. And we see that things are moving in between cities, you know, regions and the national government. And we have a role in connecting the sector, the UK sector, at all those levels internationally. And that's why we are here. What I found also really interesting was the role of women. You know, somebody said, well, if women are not part of the decision-making and so on, there will be no sustainable development. Mm-hmm. It's a bold statement, but I actually think it's important. What they came out is, well, we need to increase the percentage of women mayors, you know, because that's where, on the top level, decision-making is happening. And the reason why we are very interested in that is also because we actually develop a program in Northeast Asia, which is called Urban Futures, and particularly focus on the role of inclusion for disabled people and aging the population. So I was happy to see that in that forum, because I think, you know, inclusive societies need to consider all kinds of people with all kinds of abilities. And that means in the governance, but also in the planning of a city, in making cities more human for everybody, very important. And we feel that the role of designers, the role of artists, you know, interventions in public space, making people aware of different ways of thinking and different ways of acting and living together, is very important. Because I think artists, designers, people in the creative sector open up questions and translate things in a very accessible way sometimes, and in a way that maybe is visually more attractive, that creates experiences for people, because I believe that actually change can only happen when you really experience something, and that is something that artists can do.
Thanks to Monocle's Ziana Zulkifli in Kuala Lumpur for that report. And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. Make sure to pick up your copy of our South Korea special, which is out on all good newsstands now. And do keep an eye out for our travel guide collection too. Seoul will be hitting bookshelves, well, sooner than you think. Watch our website for more details. The programme was produced by Carlotta Ribello and edited by David Stevens. To play you out of this edition of The Urbanist, here's the Malaysian singer Yuna with Someone Out of Town. Thanks for listening, city lovers.
See you clearly now.